History is messy. It's weird, wild, and anything but boring. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a history podcast about unhinged stories that make you stop and ask, wait, is this real life?
From crazy disasters and tasty scandals to enlightening and surprising heartwarming tales, we explore the moments where people behave badly and sometimes beautifully.
We've got naughty politicians, cultural chaos, and a deep love for the Pacific Northwest, including Bigfoot.
It's thoughtful, irreverent, occasionally serious, and always entertaining.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
MSW Media. MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
I'm Michael Isikoff, and this is Spy Talk.
Russia has launched a big missile and drone attack on Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. Large explosions were reported and at least 9 people have been killed. Well, the latest pictures from Kyiv show that the damage appears to be extensive, with the city's mayor saying that the attack caused several fires and dozens of people were being treated in hospital. It is one of the biggest attacks in recent months.
That's a BBC anchor describing Russia's punishing missile attack on Ukraine's capital last week. A deadly assault, all the more shocking given that it took place right in the middle of peace talks aimed at ending the war, brokered by President Trump's personal envoy, Steve Witkoff. Even Trump himself, in an extremely rare move, rebuked Russian President Vladimir Putin over the strike. "Vladimir, stop," he wrote on social media. But for all the attention paid to the president's plaintive plea to Putin, Trump's administration was making other, much more pleasing moves to Russia's dictator. The president's own peace plan calls for the U.S. to formally accept Russia's annexation of Crimea, a land grab that was denounced by the U.S., Europe, and much of the rest of the world when Putin seized the Ukrainian territory in 2014. And at the same time, the State Department is shutting down offices that have been compiling evidence from Western intelligence agencies of Russian war crimes in Ukraine, including the targeting of civilian infrastructure and the kidnapping of thousands of children and placing them in indoctrination camps. What's behind these moves and what message do they send to Putin? And what does it mean for hopes of holding the Russian Federation accountable for what it's done in the country? We'll talk to Stephen Rapp, the former U.S. Ambassador at Large in charge of the Office of Global War Crimes, an office that the Trump administration has just eliminated on this episode of Spy Talk. Ambassador Stephen Rapp, welcome to Spy Talk.
Good to be with you.
Really interested in talking to you. You're a former U.S. attorney in Iowa, but you're primarily known as a war crimes prosecutor. You've been doing this for many years in Rwanda, in Africa against the former Liberian dictator, Charles Taylor. But and also in recent years, very much focused on Syria. But I want to ask you, start out with what we've learned just in the last few days about plans for a major reorganization of the State Department to close offices on human rights, democracy, war crimes, and conflict prevention, eliminating 132 offices, 700 positions, among them the Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, and the Office of Global Criminal Justice, a body that seeks to investigate war crimes. It's the office you formerly headed. What's going on here? Why are these positions being eliminated, and what impact will they have?
Well, you have to talk to the advocates on why they're being eliminated. I mean, it periodically gets suggested the State Department needs to be streamlined and have fewer offices, and certainly I agree with that. However, you do need to have the experts there to be able to do the things that America needs them to do. And this office basically was created under the names War Crimes Issues in 1997 and has had ambassadors at large heading it from both political parties, including during the first Trump administration. and has been quite effective in pushing for accountability initially in supporting the work of the Yugoslavia Tribunal and bringing Milosevic and Mladic and those and Karadzic to justice, supporting Rwanda, where I prosecuted, and bringing so many of those leaders, including a prime minister, and military leaders and media leaders responsible for the genocide to account. And then Sierra Leone, where I was also prosecutor, office helped a great deal. And then in other situations that have occurred in this century, have worked to find avenues for justice, preferably at the national level. If you have a transition, we always prefer it be done at the national level. But in places like Syria, where there was no route, we worked really hard with civil society and Syrians and others in really documenting these crimes. People like Caesar, who brought out the 53,000 photos, taken under the orders of the government. He was a military police photographer. Of thousands, indeed, perhaps as many as 11,000, though 7,000 of them can be identified, of people that were tortured to death by Assad. And we worked with insider witnesses and with bringing fugitives to justice. And this affects situations that are very bipartisan. During the Trump administration, the office was very active in getting the determination that China was committing a genocide against the Uyghur population in Xinjiang, northwest China. And working to hold the North Korean regime to account, and dealing with their leftist regimes in Nicaragua and Venezuela, and helping the victims there to find accountability, and dealing with the terrorists of Boko Haram and ISIS. So it's a strange why it's going away. I can see people who don't follow these things closely.
It's not like war crimes and crimes against humanity have stopped in the world in recent years.
No, indeed. They're sadly increasing, because there hasn't been enough effective efforts to hold some of the worst guys to account. And the ICC hasn't been effective in getting most of the people that it's charged to held to account. So we often need other routes, which the U.S. is actively supported. Interestingly enough, when the office was threatened, when Secretary Tillerson was the first secretary that Trump fired at state, he wanted to get rid of the office. And Congress came to our rescue, and the leader in that effort was Senator Rubio. So
Senator Rubio, now secretary, who's actually shutting down these offices that he once
Congress
defended.
Will have, I think, a role here. I've been dealing with Congress and Mass staff and House Foreign Affairs Committee, obviously conservative Republican. They want to actually pass an authorization bill through Congress, something that hasn't happened for the State Department in a quarter century, but that would define what bureaus there should be and what they should be doing. And I think that could be a bipartisan effort. And then I think if that happens, some of the offices that are not doing very much can be consolidated, but one that I think is really delivering a lot for very little. This office can perhaps be maintained. It could be put under
Secretary
or something like that. But it needs to have a leader, and it needs to have a position and the resources to do the job.
And you were the leader of the Global Criminal Justice Office. You mentioned some of the areas where this office and these offices at the State Department have been active. But one that's very much in the news right now, and I want to focus a bit on, is Russia. Obviously, the Trump administration is very much engaged in trying to get a deal to settle, resolve the war in Ukraine. But at the same time, these offices, the Office of Global Criminal Justice in particular, has been very active in collecting intelligence about Russian war crimes in Ukraine. And they've been supporting the work of a team of prosecutors at the International Center for the Prosecution of the Crime of Aggression Against Ukraine. My understanding is that work has basically come to a halt on the U.S. side, correct?
That is correct. That office had U.S. financial support. It was at Eurojust in The Hague and it contained enough prosecutors from Ukraine and from a number of European countries. And the U.S. actually sent an experienced prosecutor and assistant U.S. attorney, a young woman, to to work in that office. She was recalled to the United States in late March, and the U.S. contribution has been canceled. The office continues, and Europe may proceed on its own.
But what is the stated justification for the United States ceasing support for documenting Russian war crimes in Ukraine?
You would have to talk to the people in the administration. I mean, I would think Secretary Rubio would want to continue to document these crimes. Obviously, the emphasis now is on trying to get a peace agreement. But, you know, you can't really have peace without justice. And at least you have to have the facts in front of you and decide how the things should be appropriately dealt with. If you don't have the facts, it's very hard to know what you're giving up. Let's put it that way. And to be frank, I don't envision that we're going to have a total peace with between Ukraine and Russia. What we could have and what we hope to have is a ceasefire, maybe something like we have in Korea, in which there's security for the South, in this case for the West, and the situation, and there's peace, but there's no final resolution, because I don't think Ukraine will ever legally recognize parts of its country having been occupied by Russia. Russia may not want to give up on its claim to Crimea, et cetera. So some of those things may be undecided, in which case justice processes will probably go forward and should. People are entitled to the truth. They're entitled to justice. So it's good.
What has the office learned about Russian war crimes in Ukraine? Can you be a little granular about what we know has been taking place?
Yeah. Now, do keep in mind, we're talking about this crime of aggression is, of course, a very special crime, which is, you know, what frankly shocked us in Ukraine. People going to school, to work, everything else. You know, on February 24th, 2022, and suddenly there's death raining from the sky, and tens of thousands of Ukrainians, more than 100,000, are called into service and they're fighting and dying at the front. At the same time that you also then have war crimes like we saw in Bucha, where you know, people are shot down in their backyards, old men on bicycles, and people are taken into dungeons and tortured to death. Women are raped, et cetera. You also have these attacks on civilians in which there's no military target around. These are war crimes, crimes against humanity. And we've also had the taking of children. Several thousand children moved out of occupied areas of Ukraine, made Russian citizens, adopted to families, separated, et cetera. A clear war crime. And the office supported the work of Yale University in documenting that. Thankfully, that documentation has been delivered to the Ukrainians now and to Europeans who can use it. But we've stopped that support. And then we've also had this program to assist the Ukrainian prosecutor that's been funded by my former office, headed by a Republican who was appointed by President Bush, Clint Williamson. The funding for that, which has employed scores of prosecutors and investigators to work directly with the Ukrainians in the field, has been frozen. We don't know what's going to happen to it.
When did that happen? When were the funds
That was all in effect of the stop work orders that were issued on January 25th. So right. for 3 months now, that's 90 days ago, we were at the end of that 90 days. There's some idea that might be unfrozen, but it's still waiting for a White House decision. State Department, I think, wants it to be unfrozen, but that's there. One of the organizations that I now head called CIJA, which has been actively involved, Commission for International Justice and Accountability in Syria, supports the Ukrainian military and national police in getting documents from the field left by the Russians to use in cases. I mean, those documents are always relevant for military operations, but they don't get to the police. So we're now getting them to the police. You can figure out which commander was telling people to go do the horrible things to the folks in Bucha, et cetera. So this is all stopped at the moment, and that's really unfortunate.
We also learned this week that there was a position at the Office of Director of National Intelligence, a coordinator, to gather intelligence from across the government of Russian atrocities committed in Ukraine and then provide that information to the Office of Criminal Justice for passing on to the Hague. What did that coordinator do? How effective was that person? And what do you make of that position being eliminated?
Well, again, that's unfortunate. You know, a lot of this hasn't been visible since the very beginning, but we do remember that we had prior to February 24th of 2022, when the full-scale invasion happened, the U.S. declassifying information about how Putin was planning the invasion. Ukraine didn't believe it. The UN didn't believe it. The rest of Europe didn't believe it. And we got all that intel out there where he was bringing troops around on a 1,500-mile front preparing this attack. And it woke people up and actually permitted the resistance to be built and prevented that attack from being successful in taking all of Ukraine. So that the stuff that's gathered from intel that can be shared, declassified, or shared in a way in which it's not used except with permission is one of the ways that we have traditionally helped courts, as we helped the Yugoslavia court on crimes like the murders and massacre, the genocide, really, in Bosnia, in Srebrenica. So, my office is, that's one of the key things it does, is it performs this liaison function between the intelligence community, which, of course, you know, has confidential, methods and means of gathering this information and works on scrubbing it and making it available to judicial processes. And that's part of a, you know, sort of all hands on deck kind of approach, using what we have in the U.S. to help justice happen. So now we've lost the key point of contact between the intelligence community and the civilians in my former office, which obviously we're working with the Ukrainians.
So one can look at all this and see a pattern. What is that pattern, and what do you make of it?
Well, I mean, I, you know, my approach is always to be bipartisan, and you know, we've got to work with the administration that that we have. But I think there are among some of them, you know, sort of an attitude of taking rank with the Russian side, and
some of them
the
who are the Putin. Some of them that you see taking the Russian side.
Well, I'm just saying that we've seen people, like the director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, who's, you know, been on RT and was in Syria supporting Assad, yeah, a vicious dictator who killed 600,000 of his own people and stole the country blind, and, you know, who was a key Russian ally and now is exiled under Russian protection in Moscow, et cetera. So, you know, there are certainly others like Secretary Rubio who have taken a very tough position when it comes to Russia. And it's like a lot of things in this administration, you'll see people on tariffs or for free trade, and, you know, and those that are for tariffs, et cetera. So, you know, you can't exactly figure out where the government's going to land, except we shouldn't disarm ourselves. And we shouldn't disarm the Ukrainians if Russia, you know, Russia hasn't agreed to anything that President Trump thought they might, like a ceasefire, when they agreed to attack halts on halt the tax on utilities. They didn't do that. When they said they would, demilitarize the Black Sea, it turned out they had all sorts of conditions before they would actually do that were impossible to meet, and they knew they'd be impossible to meet. So there really hasn't been good faith on that side. So if we're going to have any hope of negotiating a deal, we got to be backing Ukraine on justice. We got to be backing it on arms until we can make the kind of deal that'll get us to peace. But we don't get there by disarmament on either front.
And in your view, can a peaceful resolution of the Ukraine war ever take place if there is not a judicial process or a truth and reconciliation process that exposes the full extent of war crimes that took place in that country.
Well, I've been involved in dozens of situations around the world, and if there isn't accountability, you can expect it to happen again, to be frank. And one of the problems we've always had with Russia, dating back to the Soviet period, is there's never been any accountability for their crimes, not for the Holodomor, the genocide of Ukrainians in 1932-33, and not for the crimes of millions of people being taken into the Gulag and tortured, not for the crimes committed against people in Eastern Europe. After World War II, obviously, we tried the Nazis went through a process where today Germany is a contributing, democratic country that believes in the rule of law and supports accountability. Russia, headed by a former KGB agent, head station chief in Dresden, Germany, Vladimir Putin, continues to think that he can get away with mass murder. And so if you don't hold them to account, if you create kind of a Sudetenland kind of situation where they're allowed to continue to occupy various parts of the country, even despite having committed mass murder, kidnapped children, everything else, you're going to expect them to, as soon as our guard is down on the other side, to come back and do more of it, and maybe do worse. You know, we don't deal with organized crime this way. I mean, organized crime may be powerful people, but we take them out, and so you've got to deal with it in the same way. And that's what coming as a federal prosecutor to the U.S. to the international system. It's not a game. This is tough business. These are mass killers, et cetera. And if you think you can talk nice to them, unless you're really, holding them to account, you can just expect, others to suffer those same crimes in the future.
We're going to take a quick break now, and when we come back, we're going to ask the ambassador about the major work he's done in the past and the work he hopes to do in the future, exposing and prosecuting Syrian war crimes by the Assad regime. We'll be back in a moment. And we're back with Ambassador at Large Stephen Rapp, veteran war crimes prosecutor, former chief of the Office of Global Justice at the State Department, Global Criminal Justice at the State Department. We were talking a lot about Russia before, but you have been deeply involved in investigating Syrian war crimes for years. And as you mentioned in the first part of the discussion, you were while you were at the State Department, you were very much involved in and instrumental in obtaining the crucial Caesar photos, those stomach-turning photos from inside Assad's prisons, showing tortured prisoners, emaciated, bruised, just laying one on top of the other, just stomach-turning, as I say, and reminiscent of photos from the Nazi Holocaust. Tell us about the role you played in helping to expose what you have called, some of the worst war crimes. I think you've said, tell me if I'm quoting you accurately here, that the evidence of Assad war crimes is even greater than we had for the Nazis after World War II.
Yes, and I will repeat that, as difficult as it is for people to believe, but it was possible because of our support of Syrians and Syrian civil society and organizations that were able to work in the country, particularly in areas that fell to the opposition at one time or another, to get out more than a million pages of documents that show us explicitly how this regime decided to suppress what was initially a peaceful uprising. People had hoped they could have, be a normal country that went to the street and said, peaceful, peaceful, change, change, and Assad. They were picked up and disappeared to the extent of almost 200,000 people. Caesar shows us 11,000 of them tortured to death. But, I visited the mass grave since the fall of Assad. We've had insider witnesses as well that that were involved in burying tens of thousands of people in the years after Caesar left. And now we have 130,000 still missing and not a trace of them. And so, you know, you're somebody that, that tortured to death more than 100,000 people. There's no question about it. Not only that, used poison gas against his own people, bombed hospitals, drove off half the population of his country. And the worst atrocities of this 21st century. And this was an enormous challenge for those of us that had done international justice in Rwanda and Yugoslavia and Sierra Leone and elsewhere when it happened, because Russia backed and Iran backed Syria to the hilt. It was impossible to get any international court to deal with it. So we did what we could with UN investigative mechanisms working from outside the country. But the key was the support that we provided to Syrians and Syrian Americans and others in developing the documentation and then sharing that with law enforcement that could prosecute people in third countries. And we had one of the torturers convicted for 58 murders and thousands of acts of torture in Germany. We charged a guy who turns out to be one of Syria's former governors under Assad, who turned up in Los Angeles, Samir Osman Sheikh. He's now facing prosecution for torture in Los Angeles. Was arrested.
There's also one in Chicago, too. Isn't there a Syrian general?
A young woman who went to Syria for humanitarian reasons, a medical worker, and she was quickly taken into custody. She was threatened by the head of military Air Force intelligence that if she didn't confess all sorts of crazy things, they would kill her whole family. So she confessed and they hanged her. And she's buried in one of the mass graves. And that's now a federal case that's been
federal case against
the head of Air Force intelligence, Jamil Hassan, who's also been charged, by the way, in Germany and France, a real piece of work, who's head of Air Force intelligence. And so we don't know exactly where he is today. Probably either could have gone to Russia, and he may be in Lebanon. He needs to be chased up. But this all gets us to, we really worked on developing this information. We never dare even hope that there'd be change in Syria given this dictatorship. And then in December, the dictator fell. And now we have a chance to do what we always want to do, which is to try to develop justice in the country where the crimes happen, not in The Hague, not in some third country. And so this is why I'm going back this weekend for the third time since December to help finish that documentation efforts now that we've accessed not a million documents, but probably 20 million documents.
So there are 20 million documents in Syria right now that would shed light on the Assad regime and its repression. Is anybody going through them? Is anybody digitizing them so that they will be accessible?
Well, there's been efforts. Initially, survivors by the hundreds were going in there trying to find any information on their loved ones. Finally, the documents have been more safely locked up. Strategies have been developed by some international non-governmental organizations to work to begin the process of digitizing. The government is very interested, but has not yet formed a transitional justice committee to decide exactly the approach they want to take. And we want to begin this soon. and one organization that I'm involved in is ready to begin in two of the municipalities with hundreds of thousands of documents. But it's something that's needed not just for justice. I mean, we've got plenty of evidence against Assad, but we need to know who the most brutal people were beneath him that did these crimes that should be targeted for arrest wherever and for prosecution. And then we need to know the big picture. We need to know, the families need to know, what happened to their loved ones. And the way this government operated in these intelligence services, they were meticulous record keepers. This is how we know so much about what they were doing. Like we saw in the Caesar photos, they took photos of their own victims.
Right.
So,
told me the other day that you actually met with Caesar to get copies of those photos or get the photos and then getting them to the FBI, which was very crucial because the FBI crime lab was able to authenticate those photos, that these were real, I mean, when the regime itself was denying and suggesting they were photoshopped.
Frankly,
and it's
a place where the office played a role, because various U.S. diplomats were contacted about the availability of these things, and they weren't sure it was our role. And I said, of course it's our role. And I you know, went to Turkey, met Caesar, arranged for him to deliver the Caesar photos, which we took possession of at the Istanbul consulate on Easter Sunday, 2014. And I brought to the FBI, and the FBI analyzed them and determined there were no artifices, no inconsistencies. This is not fake news. And I know you later interviewed Assad in his presidential palace, which
and I handed him the FBI report that you had helped prepare.
Fake news. Yes. And he was lying. There was no question about it. You know, we had the analysis that showed that there was not a pixel out of place, that it, those photos were taken in a single instant. There was no positing or adding or deep faking or anything like that. That we were able to do that. And of course, those played a key role. I mean, they were pretty, of all the evidence that we had, they really told the story, like the 10,000 words that each picture tells us. Otherwise, it would have always been, oh, it's false statements from these disgruntled people, et cetera, that don't want to accept their government. No, we had them dead bang at that point. Of course, there's a lot more that you need to know who caused those people to have their eyes gouged out and their, you know.
By the way, Assad.
All the horrific things that we saw in those, within those corpses.
Speaking of Assad, we know that he flew off to Moscow after his regime fell with his close family and lots of money. Very little has been heard from him since, but there's been some periodic reporting in the Russian and Israeli press that he's holed up in some fancy apartments. According to a Moscow, I'm reading from a Israeli account here, quoting a Moscow-based journalist saying the Assad family has purchased no fewer than 18 different apartments throughout Moscow. The price of regular apartments stood at about $2 million. Assad's cousin, Iyad Makhlouf, has established a real estate company in Moscow. And meanwhile, the son is there, who has apparently written a doctoral thesis in Russian, in which, and when he defended his doctoral thesis, Asma Assad, his mother and her parents attended this university event. He seems to be getting full protection of the Putin regime while he's holed up there in Moscow.
And that's certainly challenging. Yes. I mean, there are others that didn't make it to Moscow that obviously, you know, any justice process would begin with. But we don't give up on Assad. We didn't give up on Charles Taylor or Milosevic, et cetera. And you know, he's a relatively young guy still. You know, the Russians are protecting him. He was their guy. On the other hand, he lost the country, you know, and was never willing to sort of take direction in terms of making the kind of compromises that he might have needed to make in order to survive. I mean, we were on a very close run thing for the last couple of years with Assad, where countries in the region wanted to reconcile with him and bring him back in, and we were fighting that. I think the Russians wanted him to do certain things; he wouldn't, so he was useless to them, and he lost them. The current government is dealing with the question of those bases, the air base and the naval base, which is the Russians' window on the Mediterranean, where they can't get through the straits at Istanbul and aren't permitted to with military ships. So they may lose this. The government said, you want to keep your bases, give us Assad.
Right. And they've said no, but they've said no. I mean, right?
Yeah, they've said no. Yeah.
I mean, the Russians are not turning Assad over.
You know, they lose their bases. Okay. But, you know, Putin's an older man than Assad. He's not going to be with us forever. And, you know, what happens when there's a transition? What happens when Russia wants to get back into the international community and wants to do things, et cetera? And there could be a transition like we have with Yeltsin. There could be a day that we can bring him back, but we never say never. And, you know, it's possible that he'll die under various indictments in Moscow. But you know, it's we develop the case, make him a pariah, and try to bring him to justice. And other places, other times it was impossible. It happened.
Yeah, Ambassador, in the best case from your perspective, we've been talking about judicial process, mm-hmm. holding people accountable. What's the mechanism for doing that with these two individuals we've been talking about, Vladimir Putin and Assad? Where would they be tried? By whom? I mean, is there any scenario that you can foresee by which this can happen?
Well, you know, obviously the U.S. has its disagreements with the International Criminal Court, but it has jurisdiction in Ukraine, and the crimes are committed in Ukraine, the war crimes and crimes against humanity, and Putin's under an indictment, and thus far that's kept him from traveling everywhere he wants to. He wasn't able to go to South Africa or Brazil for meetings with BRICS, etc. I mean, there could come a time when transition in Russia, or people decide he's running the country in the wrong direction, and he's overthrown, like this happened in other situations in the world, like even happened in Philippines with Duterte. So, you know, there could come a time when he's transferred to the ICC. As far as where Assad would go, he's not under ICC jurisdiction. That would take a decision with the Security Council. That's not going to happen with Russia's supporting him. But he could... He could certainly be charged in Syria and could go back to Syria. He faces already an arrest warrant in France because of the chemical weapons attack. There were French victims of that crime. The Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Warfare is talking about creating a tribunal in which Syria would now participate for chemical weapons attacks, and that could be created, and he could be tried at that kind of court, probably in The Hague. So there are alternatives that could be, you know, beyond Syria, where people may think that he would be lynched. I don't think he would be. I think it'd be a fair and a very important trial. But, you know, there's questions about whether the world will send him there. They should. But if they don't, we can find other alternatives. And certainly the goal, as long as I live, will be to make sure that there is a place for him to go, and that we're using all the levers that we can nationally and internationally to make it happen. Otherwise, you'll just see worse crimes being committed by people like him elsewhere.
On that point, final question. As I mentioned earlier, you've been involved in prosecutions in Africa and Rwanda and Charles Taylor, the former dictator of Liberia. But if Putin and Assad and all their henchmen are not also prosecuted for war crimes by some international tribunal, what message does that send about holding anybody accountable? If we're going to go after people in Africa who commit war crimes, how can it be justified not going after people like Putin and Assad?
Well, obviously, it sends a message that if you're, you know, commit mass murder and you have friends in high places, or you have nuclear weapons, or you're really strong, you may be able to get out of it. That's the reality of it. But, you know, we need to do everything we can to undermine that expectation and create the pathways to justice and to press forward on it. And I think, you know, the world was operating pretty well in the first decade of this century, where we were bringing the Milosevic's and the Taylors and the Kambandas to justice. In the last 15 years, since about 2010, it's been impossible to do that because of Russian obstruction to a large extent. And we just have to keep up that fight. And if we can't bring them to justice, we got to make them a pariah. We got to get to their assets. We got to do everything that we can to make sure that crime doesn't pay, or we'll just get more of it.
Ambassador Rapp, I want to thank you for a very informative discussion. And as you mentioned, you're going to Syria. We'll definitely want to stay in touch and see if your efforts are fruitful. So thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, good to be with you, Michael.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
Hey, it's Jody Hamilton.
And Sean Smith-Pierce.
Here's a taste of what you might have missed from the Politics Bar.
Jody, I was listening to you this morning, filling in for Steph. You and Chris were debating, and just for the record, Jody is right. Chris's argument is that there is some truth to what's being said about the left being in their own information silo. Right.
Basically, we started talking about how Gavin Newsom has invited people on his podcast, high up MAGA guys.
Yeah. Well-known right-wing propagandists. That's what they are. Yeah.
And my argument is he shouldn't be inviting them because nobody on that side is listening to Gavin Newsom.
Right. It doesn't help to bring propagandists into a sphere where truth matters because they're just going to lie their asses off anyway.
Right.
So here is a public service message for Chris Lavoie. Jody Hamilton is right. Catch all that and more weeknights at the Politics Bar. Available through your favorite progressive radio station, your favorite podcast player, or online anytime at thepoliticsbar.com.